In this week's Nutrition and Life episode, I speak with Professor Dr. Darren Kando, creatine specialist, scientific advisor, and consultant. Dr. Kando and I speak about all things creatine, mechanisms, potential benefits, dosage and form to take, new research in the field, and more. I'm excited for you to listen to my conversation with Dr. Kando, and if you enjoy this episode, please help us spread the message, take a screenshot, and share the episode on your social media, or leave us a rating or review. Thank you so much. Now on to my conversation with Dr. Darren Kando.
Hello and welcome back to the Nutrition and Life podcast. My name is Lisa, I'm your host, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Darren Kando. Darren is a professor, a scientific advisor, a consultant, and a creatine specialist. I'm super excited to speak with you today, Darren. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, I am interested to hear all about your research and findings. But before we get into all of that, I would just love to know a little bit about you, who you are, what made you so interested in creatine?
Yeah, it was kind of by accident. I think a lot of academics fall into things by accident. And one of my undergrad degree was in cell biology, which was great. But I was starting to work out at the time, and I was only about 18 or 19, and I started to realize the importance of nutrition, really post-exercise and adequate sleep and things like that. And I started to take a few classes in kinesiology, and it really started to click for me, the biological sciences meeting the human aspect. And then I went on to do graduate work and looked at the amino acid glutamine. And during my graduate degree, I found out it didn't really do anything for muscle growth or performance. And we've come to now know, you know, a non-essential amino acid, you need all the amino acids or building blocks to be there. So it was a very eye-opening experience, because as a graduate student, you go in, you're doing all this work. And then when you find out that your study was didn't find any significance, it was kind of heartbreaking at the time. But my advisor said, you know, it's really good to show things don't work. That really gives a lot of evidence to a lot of people, maybe not to waste their money and maybe not be safe. And at the same time, I was looking at glutamine. My colleague, Dr. Darren Burke, who's now in the industry, he was looking at creatine. And creatine had a huge a body of momentum behind it. It seemed like every study was coming out. Individuals were gaining muscle mass, getting stronger, and having greater recovery. And so I sort of branched and followed that pattern. And we went into younger individuals, and then it really blossomed into older adults. We started to see some really good effects in older males and females. And I've been doing creatine research primarily for the last two decades. I think we know a little bit more than what we used to. But each day that comes out, it's evolving. And I'm sure we'll get in today that we used to focus on just skeletal muscle. And now we're starting to introduce, what about the effects on body fat? What about bone health? And of course, the big one is brain health. So it's a hot topic area. But I sort of fell into creatine by accident, or just following some really exceptional researchers. But I'm glad I did. So there's a little bit of a short summary on the bio, I guess, from an academic perspective.
Well, I love it. Sounds great and very interesting. And even though it is always referenced as the most researched supplement, it's lovely to hear that there's always new things to investigate, right, to find out as well. Mm-hmm. But before we talk about some of the findings, I would just love to hear, what is creatine really? Just for those that are new to this, or maybe are not quite familiar with it.
Yeah, it's a molecule that was discovered in 1832, way before ATP. So basically, it helps maintain the energy currency of all our cells, muscle, bone, brain cells. But it's not a protein or an amino acid, but it looks like it from a chemical structure. We're naturally making creatine in our liver and brain on a daily basis, about 1 to 3 grams on average. But we can also consume this molecule from food products such as red meat and seafood. So right there alone, if you're a vegan, vegetarian, or emphasizing a plant-based diet, we'll get into discussions today about some of the difficulties of getting habitual dietary creatine. And of course, that leads into supplementation. Everybody's probably, oh, I heard of creatine supplementation. Isn't that just for athletes? Well, the answer is no. Everybody can consume it, or at least consider it. It typically comes in powder form. And when the rest of the discussion, when we refer to creatine, I'll be referring to creatine monohydrate. It's the one that has the most research behind it. And monohydrate, meaning one, a creatine linked to water. When it comes into the body, the water molecule dissolves in the stomach, and that creatine molecule is identical to what we're naturally producing. And that's probably why the safety profile of creatine is exceptional. There's been multiple study after study showing no adverse effects on the kidney or liver, probably because we're producing it. And that also leads to the segue. Pretty much anybody on the planet could consume creatine because our body recognizes it. So again, it's just there to help maintain the energy currency of our cell. And of course, it got its famous implications for athletes because if it maintains energy or gives you a little bit of potential extra boost, so to speak, these individuals can maybe perform more repetitions in the gym, run faster, and recover faster. So I'd be shocked at the recent Paris Olympics if not all athletes were at least on creatine or increasing dietary creatine. It's easy to do, but we'll get into some of the nuances with supplementation practices. Do you actually need supplementation? Those are big things to discuss for sure.
Absolutely, so many avenues we can take this to, but I do actually want to start right there because you mentioned it is also present in food and in red meat, especially, and so on. So one might ask themselves, can I get sufficient? And what is sufficient? I guess that's the other question, but can I get sufficient through my diet? And what would that have to look like?
So again, we're not just synthesizing about 1 to 3 grams, but we actually excrete or metabolize about 1 to 3 grams in the form of something called creatinine. And a lot of your viewers say, oh, when I went to get my blood work done at the doctor, he checked off that box. So just let's say if there's an equal balance, what you're naturally creating and excreting is zero. The minimal effective dose, just from a muscle perspective, is 3 grams. So you can get 3 grams through your diet very easily, but you have to be an omnivore or a carnivore. To get 3 grams of creatine, you'd have to eat an entire kilogram of codfish. You'd probably have to eat at least a large red steak a day. So money, the cost of groceries nowadays, what if you're a vegan? Those all become issues. But the vast majority of research suggests that more than 3 grams has beneficial effects, maybe 5 grams or more, and that's not even considering bone or brain. So this is one of the areas where supplementation just seems to be a very viable and attractive option. Creatine supplementation is relatively inexpensive. Again, the safety profile is second to none. And the dose, maybe if you want to get 8 or 10 grams, unless you live in the Scandinavian countries, it's very difficult to get that through red meat and or seafood. You'd have to be eating multiple servings a day. So again, it can be done, but that's why I think a lot of people, I would venture, I guess 90% of people considering creatine just say supplementation is very easy.
Right, that makes sense. And the differences in dosage, what would that be based on? Body weight or height or activity level?
Yeah, there's three ways to go. So if you're the athlete, Paris Olympics, World Championships, it's very common to do something called the loading phase. It's 20 grams of creatine a day for about 7 days. And then you reduce it all the way down to anywhere between 2 to 5 grams a day as a maintenance phase. That's a very rapid and effective way to saturate your muscles, sort of fill up your living room full of creatine. The only issue with the loading phase is it can cause some adverse effects, such as bloating, GI tract irritation. But the big one, especially for young females, is rapid or acute weight gain. It's primarily water retention, but a lot of people say, whoa, I gained 4 pounds on the loading phase. I don't want to take this. And that's very understandable. I think that one's only for the elite athlete. The one that everybody can consume on a daily basis, you can start as little as 3 grams a day. Take that for the rest of your life. That will accumulate. We don't think 3 grams a day is good enough for the bone or brain, but we can talk about maybe slightly increasing it. But 3 grams is pretty good as a starting point for skeletal muscle. And then we use a relative dosing strategy. The idea is, what if a larger person, like maybe a large biological male who's 100 kilograms, is that dose too much for a smaller biological female who's 50 kilograms? Well, the theory is that the larger you are, you have more muscle mass, you may have more doorways to allow creatine in. So we use a relative dosing, 0.1 gram per kilogram. So if I go on the scale and I'm 90 kilograms, I get 9 grams a day. If you go on the scale and you're 60 kilograms, you get 6 grams a day. That controls for biological sex and experimental studies. It also controls for the size of the person so we can make an equal comparison. Those are the three main areas. I think anybody listening, it's really important. You technically do not need supplementation. You can get it through your diet or naturally produce it. But if you're considering it, I think starting as little as 3 grams a day, ignore what's on the bottle, start as little as 3 grams a day. Do that for maybe a week or so, see how you feel, work your way up maybe to 5. And if you're only interested in muscle benefits, you can stop at 5. But I think we'll get into discussions maybe on some bone health or brain. You're going to need more. We'll talk about why you will. I personally only take 10 grams a day, and I divide that up into 2 5-gram dosages. 10 grams seems to be the average to hit all three areas. I'd be very shocked if anybody would benefit more long term over 10 grams. That's quite a bit. But at the end of it, that's a teaspoon. We're not talking hundreds of grams like protein. At most, a teaspoon throughout the day, you can divide that up. It's really whatever's consistent for you. But there's only select populations, unless you're born with a creatine synthesis deficiency, maybe some catabolic or certain issues like HIV, cancer, cachexia would need more. But a healthy individual, I'd be shocked if they need more than 10 grams a day.
And you mentioned the as long as you can stick to it, and I think that's always such an important point because I do often get asked, oh, what time of the day would be optimal, or, and so on. And maybe you can tell us more about that. But what I usually recommend is just whenever you can stick with it. If you're having a daily protein shake, just put it in there anyway, or in your water in the morning, or whatever. But yeah, maybe there is some more research in regards to timing that I'm not aware of.
Yeah, it's not like caffeine where it will spike in the blood and you sort of get that boost. It needs to accumulate. And so the timing was a very popular issue. We've done the majority of studies looking at the timing, and I'm happy to state that the timing is essentially irrelevant. You can take it in the morning, right before your workout, during your workout, like I do, right after, before going to bed. It needs to get through your small intestine, then get into the bloodstream, and then be taken up into your demanding cells. So the cool thing with creatine, you can take it at any time. But we've looked at immediate before exercise compared to immediately after. No difference. Other studies have looked at it in the morning or afternoon. So I take 5 grams with my yogurt and things in the morning, and then I actually put 5 grams in a water bottle and I drink that during my workout. I find that creatine dissolves it. There's no taste. So there's my 10 grams. Now, when I have to fly to different continents, and I'm very susceptible to jet lag. We can talk about that in the brain area, but I actually do go above 10 grams leading up to those sleep deprivation or jet lag opportunities, because I think the brain is really stressed, and we can talk about the phenomenal abilities of the brain to say, I need help when I'm stressed. And if you've ever had to, stay up overnight, students watching, cramming for midterms, you have to fly to Asia. These are long metabolically stressors because of the duration. And sometimes the brain needs help. More times than not, it says, no, I don't need creatine supplementation. But we'll talk about that as well. So I'm very excited.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear more about that because I'm actually a digital nomad, and so I travel a lot, and therefore, yes, experience a lot of jet lag. So I'm very excited to hear about that. But before we talk about that, I would love to just hear a little bit more about the water retention aspect. Because of course, I work with a lot of specifically female clients, and almost all of them, even though we don't do a loading phase per se, but almost all of them experience maybe a pound or two of an increase. And I always try to emphasize that that's actually a good thing. But yeah, maybe you can explain the mechanism behind that.
So creatine by itself is technically an osmotic compound. So if you can remember back to high school biology, when it enters the bloodstream and goes to your demanding tissues, it likes to drag water with it that maintain that equilibrium. So sometimes what will happen is you get an increase in intracellular water, which is actually a good thing. All the potential mechanisms of creatine get turned on when the cell will swell in the cytoplasm or with water. So having water in the cell seems to turn on a lot of the good things like satellite cells, transcription factors, things that we think can help explain why people get an increase in lean tissue mass or muscle performance. But the interesting thing is when we do these studies and we don't do a loading phase, if you do get an increase on the scale, it usually goes away after about 7 to 10 days. And when we measure them post-testing, their weight hasn't changed. What we're actually finding is that the lean tissue mass in conjunction with resistance training went up, their fat mass might have went down. So this is something for young females, especially that just have a little bit of patience. If you do know a little bit of bloating or experience it, it usually goes away. But a thing that we sort of found out anecdotally is whatever dose you're taking, you may want to divide that up into a few smaller dosages. So for example, we're doing a study now comparing a bolus of 5 grams versus two 2.5 gram dosages. My thought is that it's the same volume of creatine, but by having a smaller absolute amount, it may have less water drag at first. You may get the same amount over time, causing all those beneficial effects. And lo and behold, a lot of individuals say, hey, I'm not getting nearly as much water retention. I like this a lot better. I wouldn't go any lower than 1 gram per serving. That dose doesn't seem to saturate or spike the amount of creatine in the blood. But I think as little as two, 2.5 or more over time. So 10 grams a day, let's use my example. I could take 3 grams in the morning, 3 grams at lunch, and maybe 4 grams post-exercise. There's 10 grams a day. A lot of people say they're liking this strategy a lot more.
I can imagine, especially in terms of the bloating and just also taste wise or
That's right.
whatever it might be, absolutely.
And
But
the
I'm
other
glad that.
thing, sort of interrupt, but the other thing is when people add the creatine to food, it seems to really decrease the bloating because the body's going through a lot of other digestive processes, maybe fiber. So I usually have a pretty good protein breakfast in the morning. I put whey protein in with Greek yogurt and collagen, and I put 5 grams of creatine in there, and I don't notice any bloating or adverse effects there, but that's just me, but other people may not respond the same.
Brilliant, but still a good tip for those that have experienced bloating, and I'm certainly thankful that you cleared up the water retention thing as being something bad. Often we associate water retention with subcutaneous or just in general water where we don't want it to be. But yeah, now let's get into the cognitive effects, because that is, it seems more recent to me anyway, maybe the last 5 years or so that we've really heard about it. And I just love what I'm hearing in terms of the studies on even adolescents, but also even the elderly.
Got it.
So yes, please educate us.
Yeah, so it's an interesting, our skeletal muscles, which retain the vast majority of creatine, they act as a vacuum and they love to take in all the creatine from the blood. But the brain is a bit different. We all know we have the blood-brain barrier for a reason. And so it acts as like a force field that sort of says, hey, I don't really need creatine coming in from the blood because we make our own creatine. So this is where it gets a little bit different from a dosing perspective, where we have the blood-brain barrier, and then of course the brain will make its own. 9 times out of 10, if you're a young individual with adequate sleep and proper nutrition, you probably won't experience any beneficial effects or noticeable effects from creatine from a cognitive or memory perspective. However, the best evidence that seems to be coming out almost on a weekly basis is when you go through periods of sleep deprivation, metabolic stress, jet lag, staying up overnight. Whenever the brain is stressed, that's when it seems to say, hey, I need help. Creatine supplementation may come to the rescue. So supplementation can cross the blood-brain barrier really at a slow rate, but it does accumulate. And that might help offset any of the metabolic stressors, which actually increase the demand for creatine. So it's interesting that when the brain is stressed, everybody can identify when they have stressful periods. That's when creatine seems to come to the rescue. And probably the majority of the good research is showing sleep deprivation. So these individuals volunteer to be sleep deprived, they stay up all night. And then when they have to do a battery of cognitive or memory tasks in the morning, their performance is much better than those that did not take creatine. So that's what we're starting to see. We're also seeing some benefits on memory in older adults, which I think has massive implications potentially for dementia, Alzheimer's disease down the road. So we're starting to see now it's not just for athletes, anybody can consider this, but the big issue compared to muscle is that on average, the best dose that seems to be the most effective is about 20 grams a day for at least a week, or we've shown 5 grams a day for several months. So if we sort of backtrack a little bit, I think if you're taking 3 to 10 grams a day, however you want to do it, it'll eventually accumulate into the brain. If you're really metabolically stressed, if your job is keeping you up all night, you have poor sleep, young children, you may benefit more from having a higher dose. And that's what the preliminary research is suggesting. The really interesting thing is, unlike muscle, it doesn't matter your natural dietary preference. So a vegan or an omnivore, will have the same amount of creatine in the brain, unlike muscle, where obviously a vegan is going to have a lot less. So the brain is very protective. And of course, that does make sense because the brain does make its own creatine where muscle doesn't. So, like for example, if I'm flying to China actually next month, I will actually increase above 10 grams up to 20 for that week going, because I'm probably going to be susceptible to jet lag, different time zones, hoping that when I land, I'm not as foggy. It's almost like long COVID, and of course, coming back. So your body will excrete anything it doesn't use. But I think during times of metabolic stress, it's okay to increase the amount. Again, the safety profile is exceptional.
That's really, really great to hear for young parents, perhaps, but also I also used to be a shift worker, so I wish I would have
Okay.
known that back then.
Yes.
But no, brilliant that that is coming out. And I don't know if that's correct, but some of the first research with creatine in conjunction with cognition, was that kind of done on TBIs as well, or brain injuries specifically?
Yeah, so I mean, if we could ever do a big study on concussion, I think it would be groundbreaking. But to TBI and concussion is one of the biggest areas. The study was only done in young children, and this is where the young children, unfortunately, when they suffered a TBI or concussion, they were immediately randomized to creatine at a high dose, 0.4 grams per kilogram. But what they started to notice after 3 and 6 months is that the recovery, self-care, speech really seemed to improve quicker from a statistical standpoint in the children on creatine. And remember, their brain is in repair mode immediately. Whenever a child gets banged or hit, they're in repair mode immediately. So creatine just came and sort of accelerated the rate of recovery compared to the children that didn't. But we need a lot more research into it. We're not seeing any reason not to. So if your child or you're involved in contact sport, we're not seeing any reason you shouldn't be taking creatine because of the potential to have some beneficial effects, especially from decreasing inflammation or oxidative stress in those cells in the brain to recover more. And that's probably why it seems to work when your brain is metabolically stressed. The other big area is clinical depression and anxiety. Some researchers out of Utah, some psychiatrists, have now shown that females who are clinically depressed but still on medication, that's a really important caveat. When they added creatine to their normal medication program, they really got substantial improvements by decreasing symptoms of depression. So pay attention to that or stay tuned. I think in a few years, you're going to see some big clinical trials showing that this metabolite, maybe added to a normal regimen, can have some health effects. And they're starting to see some really good effects in clinical depression.
Oh, very, very promising or very exciting research.
Yes.
I'm absolutely dying to ask you about the research on bone health and so on as well. But before I forget, I really want to ask you about creatinine
Yeah.
blood marker, because
Yes.
time and time again, people start taking creatine and then they come back from taking a blood test without, kind of speaking to me about it beforehand. And their doctor or physician told them, oh, no, this marker is high. And on top of
Yes.
that, they're probably strength training and
Right.
didn't stop any supplementation beforehand. So maybe we can shed some light on why that is high or what would be a good protocol pre-blood
Right.
test to get
Yes.
an accurate reading.
Right. Yeah. So it's called creatine, but when it's taken into your demanding cells and metabolized or used, it gets broken into something called creatinine. And that's a metabolic byproduct. And at the beginning of the podcast, people are like, oh, on the form of blood requisition, they'll check off glucose and creatinine. And creatinine is an indicator of kidney function. It's a bad indicator, but it is still an indicator for GPs and nephrologists to use as an indicator of kidney function. Because what it means is if you have high creatinine in the blood, that means the kidneys are not filtering it. So typically, when you're a healthy individual not taking creatine or working out or having a high protein diet, your creatinine levels are very low. But it's logical to assume that if you're taking creatine supplementation or eating a lot of meat and seafood, your creatinine levels were probably going to be higher because you're having more in the body. That does not necessarily mean you have kidney and or liver issues, but it does cause alarm and a false positive. So 9 times out of 10, usually when you're on creatine supplementation, those values typically do get elevated, and your doctor, and rightfully so from a caution standpoint, say, whoa, we need you to stop that supplement. And then when you come back, usually those numbers are back to baseline, simply proving that it's the metabolism of the supplement or the diet. So make sure you tell your doctor, hey, I'm on supplementation. Please be aware of my creatinine. And then your GFR levels, which are used to indicate or measure kidney function, are probably going to be elevated. And most people, when they do tell their doctor, everything is fine. But there's been clinical trial after clinical trial showing that creatine has no adverse effects on filtration rate or liver enzymes compared to placebo. So that's something that I think if your listeners are thinking of, make sure when you go for your annual work that you don't get scared because you need to be honest with your doctor.
Very, very good point. And yeah, thank you for explaining that. That makes perfect sense that way. So yes, one of the ways how I became aware of your work is because I saw a study posted or something posted citing your work on creatine and bone
Right.
health. Yes. So I'd
Okay.
love to hear more about that.
Yeah. There's a small body of research that has sort of started to focus away from skeletal muscle on bone. And of course, when we look in the mirror, we see lean tissue and body fat. We never really consider what's underneath. And especially from a biological female perspective, which have a higher prevalence of osteopenia and osteoporosis, it's a major factor globally. And one of the things with creatine, our bone cells, just like our muscle cells, rely on creatine for energy. And if those bone building cells become energized, that could have some advantageous effects. And some preliminary rodent model and in vitro model or evidence show that when you put bone building cells in the presence of creatine, they became energized. So then, of course, researchers says we thought was, wow, if these bone building cells became energized, maybe that could have some beneficial effects on the skeleton. So there's probably been about 15 studies globally that have now looked at creatine, always usually in combination with resistance training or exercise. And there's been I would say the minority have shown some beneficial effects, but let's talk about those studies because they were very interesting. The best results seem to come in postmenopausal females, which is great. Postmenopausals have the highest prevalence for osteoporosis. It's probably due to the cessation of estrogen or adequate amounts of estrogen. And we're starting to see, and we've done the most trials looking at the hip. So when you were to fall and you know suffer a hip fracture, that is debilitating. But in postmenopausal females who trained for 1 year all the way up to 2 years and took creatine supplementation, now this is where the dose was 0.1 or 0.14 grams per kilogram. So on average, these females were taking anywhere between 8 to 12 grams a day for a year or all the way up to 2. The interesting thing is compared to placebo, it preserved bone mineral density around the hip region and actually made the bone a bit stronger or maintained the strength of the bone compared to those on placebo. So what we started to hypothesize is maybe creatine can help preserve some of the skeleton around those precious areas. The interesting thing, though, is the females who did not take creatine had a slight reduction. So therefore, exercise is the driving force, and creatine may have some beneficial effects. Creatine has also been shown to reduce markers of bone breakdown. So anybody watching, you probably heard of bisphosphonates. These are drugs that you can take to maintain bone integrity. So when you put it all together, I think the best conclusion is that a few studies have shown some bone preserving effects. Now I will be honest, there's more studies showing that creatine did not have a significant improvement on bone, probably because the studies weren't long enough or the dose wasn't long enough. So the next logical step is maybe take females who have osteoporosis and see if that can have some favorable effects. But I think for the biological females listening, and of course the biological males get a response as well. But if you have a history of osteoporosis, or you're not eating a lot of dairy, or you have a small frame, creatine and exercise can potentially have some bone preservation or beneficial effects.
That's also great to hear. But just to clarify, almost all the research had creatine and strength training in combination, or is
Yes.
there some with just creatine as well?
Only the studies that showed benefits had creatine with resistance training. There's been great research out of Brazil showing that creatine by itself had no bone benefits. So you need that mechanical stimuli to sort of cause the muscle to pull on the bone as well. So please know it's not like you can take creatine and sit on the couch. To get the bone benefits, if you're going to get any, you definitely need to exercise. Yeah.
That makes sense in my eyes. I would I'd love to hear if there's any let's say, contraindications for taking creatine, or even it's just a specific food that we shouldn't take it in combination with, or anything like that?
We seem to get a synergistic or greater effect when you combine creatine with protein. There's the idea there that the beneficial effects of protein, they sort of go hand in hand. The debate or the issue comes with high dose caffeine. So my answer to this has sort of changed a little bit because the best cellular research suggests, and this is coming from the Europe, that when creatine is combined with caffeine above 200 milligrams, they can't interfere with each other. But your average typical coffee has about 80 milligrams. But if you're consistently putting your creatine in a large coffee every day, you may get an interference effect. Since we don't really know if they do, my recommendation, and where the timing of creatine is irrelevant, but the timing of caffeine is really important. You want to take that caffeine within an hour. I think you can wake up, have your morning coffee, whichever it is. If you want to do your pre-workout and it has a bunch of things in there, that's probably fine. But you can take creatine any other time of the day and they may not interfere. So I guess the best way to answer this is if you've been putting your creatine in your coffee and you're not noticing any effect, you're a non-responder, maybe try splitting it up. But if you've been putting it together and you're noticing great effects, I'm all for it. Go ahead. I think the dose of caffeine is probably more imperative than just saying I'm putting it in coffee or tea. Yeah.
Right, so maybe not a quadruple espresso or something like
Yeah,
that.
that could degrade it. But if you drank it really quickly, I'm thinking it's in your system. But a lot of people, a large Starbucks would have about 400 milligrams of coffee or a caffeine, and you put your creatine in there and you're sipping on it all day. The caffeine, the acidity of it may degrade it. But we just don't know. But I will say, from an evidence-based perspective, the majority of research is suggesting an interference effect from higher dose caffeine.
Okay, I understand. Yes. That's
Well, I never mix the two. I'm a caffeine junkie. I have, I don't know, God, 6, 7 K cups a day. I got to stop that, but I never mix the two. Yeah, so I don't know.
good to know. In terms of the form, I have heard of creatine. Well, we spoke about creatine monohydrate, and there's lots of others like creatine ethyl ester or whatnot. But you mentioned that creatine monohydrate is the most researched one, and the most what it appears at this stage anyway, the most beneficial one or cost effective one also. Is there any merit to taking any of the other forms or not? Really not, in no case.
There's no reason to mess with the top of the hill. So creatine is by far at the top of the hill monohydrate. It's the one that's been shown to be effective in all the tissues and the safest. All these new marketed forms, my argument against these marketed forms is monohydrate is almost 100% bioavailable. That means that molecule will get through your small intestine into the blood, into your cells. Some other marketed forms of creatine, first, it has to be creatine when it's metabolized. And whatever's added to it, I just struggle to see can it be any better? Because sometimes it may get into tissue equally, but it's never been shown to be superior. So, since creatine monohydrate is relatively inexpensive and safe, I question why someone would go to an alternative brand, or maybe it's more expensive. But I know it's a boring white powder. People say, hey, I need something new. But in this case, I think you want to go to old reliable and stay with monohydrate. Yeah.
Sounds good. And I heard that creatine monohydrate Creapure
Yes.
is worth looking out for. Is that just signalizing that it's a very pure form of the creatine monohydrate?
Yeah, it comes out of Laufen, Germany, and the plant is extremely beneficial for my AllChem. I do advise you work for AllChem, but I've been lucky to visit the plant. So Creapure is a form of creatine monohydrate, but it's third-party tested, no impurities, and they put a lot of quality assurance into the product. So at the end of it, if people are considering it, please look for creatine monohydrate. Please definitely make sure that that label is third-party tested, either certified, safe, NSF, to make sure that there's no contaminants in there. But Creapure is the world-leading form of creatine monohydrate. Yeah.
That's very good to know. Just when looking for a product, you might as well look for the best possible one and all that in the jungle out there. I obviously want to make sure I respect your time, Darren, but I do have a question because you mentioned earlier that your research initially started with glutamine. And up until a couple of years ago, I was not really very aware of any bodybuilding practices, et cetera. But once I kind of became a bit more involved in this space, I found out everybody and their dog was taking glutamine from what it felt like. Is that also a supplement that you recommend? You already mentioned it's obviously not for building muscle. We know that. And yeah, but if you do recommend it, what is it good for?
Yeah, so if you're a healthy individual, 100% no. It's a non-essential amino acid you're naturally getting, obviously synthesized or the diet, and it's one of 19. It's not leucine. The only time glutamine may have some application is long duration athletic sports where inflammation is really, really elevated. But from a healthy standpoint, it's going to have no beneficial effects whatsoever on muscle growth or performance. I think you're better off to focus on whole body or complete protein sources.
Great. That's good to know. I think whenever I asked people, it was mostly recommended for gut lining benefits or more like making sure intestinal
There is potential for gut health and glutathione, but I think a lot of people are looking at the prebiotic or probiotic. But from an exercise performance perspective, no, I would rank it up there as one of the most worthless supplements marketed from a performance or body composition perspective.
Interesting. Very, very good to know. Yeah, thank you. One last question. What's something in the area that excites you, something new that might be coming out or that you're currently working on?
Yeah, we're really starting to focus on older adults with diagnosed conditions such as osteoporosis or sarcopenia and looking at the different dosing patterns. One of the big areas we're looking at is female health from premenopausal to the transition to postmenopausal. Is there a difference there? Looking at muscle and bone. So we're starting to focus on younger individuals across the lifespan as well as older individuals as well. But I'm really intrigued, can creatine be an anti-sarcopenic effect? Can it take adults who are diagnosed with low muscle mass, strength, and functionality and reverse that? So I think those are studies we're starting to look at that as well to have some application from a health perspective.
Very cool. And is that going to be in conjunction with the strength training or resistance training as well, or on?
Yeah, strength training, and we're actually using resistance bands. So these can now the interesting thing, they can stay at home. COVID's taught us, hey, the last thing you want to do is not do anything. But these are resistance bands. You can actually get a pretty effective workout. They can travel with these bands and they don't need a lot of money to buy expensive equipment. So we're starting to look at alternate forms of exercise that anybody can do, especially if they have joint issues and then combine it with nutrition. So that's our focus right now.
Great. I can only imagine what change could be done if people combine protein, creatine, and strength training all together and offset and most maybe even build some muscle. That would be lovely.
I love that segue. I think the biggest thing is we gotta hopefully motivate people to move and exercise first. Supplements will give you a minimal beneficial effect, but it's still beneficial. But out exercise, none of these things really work. So you gotta be able to move and lift things whenever you can, and get the heart rate up when you can. But exercise will always be the foundation of youth or longevity. Supplements have a place, but they're not a miracle. You still need to do the work to get the results.
Yeah, that's fortunate, I
I
guess. But I
know.
always try to compare it with like a car. You can have the best possible car with fuel and oil and everything in it. If you never turn the key, which
That's
essentially
right.
is what strength training is, nothing is ever going to happen.
Exactly,
Not
exactly.
anyway. But yeah, Dr. Darren Cano, thank you so much for your time. This has been incredibly interesting. And yeah, I really just appreciate you coming on the show today.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Darren Kendo. Thank you so much for tuning in. And if you would like some more content, go and give us a follow on Instagram or YouTube. One more thing before you go, if you are looking for premium supplements, our partner at Fat Muscle Project has got you covered. Head over to their website for the best protein powders, creatine, vitamin D, and more. Feel free to use our code NCL at the checkout. Thank you for listening, and don't forget, life is too short to be in a body you don't feel good in.